This week on the Barg World Show, we're joined by Dan James from Silver Orange to talk about what to do when things go wrong. Season 12 of the Barg World Show is sponsored by Lynda.com and Template Monster. Go to their websites and give your monitor a big kiss from me. Bowagwall.com, the podcast. You know, I can't be bothered.
Again.
I've drunk sangria.
Have you?
I've been sitting in the garden, and now I'm just very sleepy, and I don't want to do the podcast.
Well, that means it's going to be the best podcast ever, then.
Could be. Could go either way. Is that Dan James, I hear?
It is Dan James, all the way across the pond in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island.
What's the weather like with you? Because the last I saw, you were still photographing snow.
It is abysmal. It is a 12 degrees Celsius today and pouring rain.
Ah, good. It's nice for somebody to have worse weather than us. It doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, you must get, like, we always say we maybe get 1 month a year when it's nice. You must get, like, one day.
Yeah, well, we get, there's probably one or two days that are nice before the mosquitoes come out. So in between the snow and the mosquitoes, there is about 48 hours of enjoyable and bearable weather.
And you're probably working during those 48 hours as well.
Yeah, exactly. They're always a Monday and a Tuesday.
So as you can hear, Marcus is with us as normal. Mm-hmm. So Marcus, I was thinking you could do this week's show.
No. I've been doing actual work today, not drinking sangria. It's your responsibility, Paul.
I've been doing work and drinking sangria. Does that count?
Are you still? I saw you posted a photograph earlier of you lying in a hammock.
I can work from a hammock.
Yeah,
it can be done. Anyway, for those that don't know, Dan, see, this is the problem with drinking sangria.
I do have two first names.
Yeah, which does very confuse things, Dan. Yeah. So for those that don't know Dan James, Dan was one of the founders of Silver Orange, which are a pretty well-known agency over in Canada, which you can tell from the way he said a boot earlier.
A boot does precede me.
Yes, exactly. So tell us a bit, because we were talking about the first time we met you just before we hit record, which was at a Future Web Design conference, where you gave the most amazing talk. And announced to the whole room what your salary was, as I remember.
Oh, yes. So where do you want me to start?
Well, tell us tell us a little bit about Silver Orange, for those that don't know, because you're weird, aren't you? You're basically the hippie commune of web design agencies.
Yeah, we prefer to call ourselves communists, or at least very right-leaning, or at least very conservative socialists when it comes to business. So Silver Orange is, believe it or not, 16 years old.
Wow.
This coming August 11th, which, I mean, in terms of the internet, it's pretty much from the dawn of the internet we've been around. It was about seven guys got together just out of high school and said, like, hey, this internet thing really could go somewhere. So we started doing really local brochureware. And we just kind of started there, and then we got really lucky with a few blog posts. So our creative director wrote a blog post criticizing a small web browser at the time called Phoenix that we then were invited to participate in rebranding it into Firefox. So the Firefox logo was actually first sketched out in the building I'm standing in right now. And then that led to bigger and crazier things. And it kind of kicked us off from there. So we've been doing design and development work for the last 16 years for everyone from Mozilla to small companies you've never, ever heard of.
But what's really interesting about Silver Orange, beyond your work, which I'm sure is fascinating, I'm not in any way knocking your work, is the way that you structure yourselves, because everybody is kind of equal, or at least was last time we talked.
Yeah, and that's really because of the DNA of our company was a group of friends sitting around and starting a business, and a large enough group of friends that, you know, you have to kind of figure out that sharing and ownership stuff right off the get-go. And when you have seven people in the room starting a company together, you kind of have to be equals. It's very hard to find someone or small group of people who are going to be absolutely in charge. So right off the bat, we just didn't know any other way that you could run a company. We thought it was normal to, you know, equally share everything. So when the first employee came on board, you know, a year or two later, it just made sense to bring them on at the same salary. So at Silver Orange, for the past 16 years, every single person gets paid the exact same salary. One small caveat there is someone new, we have a ramp up kind of schedule that for the first year and a half, they're not quite at a full, what we call a full salary, but they quickly get there.
And you've been also very open as a company, very open and honest with one another about, you know, what's going on, what the financials are, how, you know, how things operate. And you're also very open publicly about that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, so internally, everyone has access to all financial documents. So like our annual financial statements are available to everyone, as well as we have a group we call the Board of Directors. They're not technically, like, legally a Board of Directors, but they meet once a month and go over all of our financials and the consequences and ramifications of that. And all those documents, and actually that meeting is open to the entire company. Hmm. So all the notes from the meeting, all of the spreadsheets, all of that is available to everyone whenever they want. And we encourage questions and input into it from everyone. So we're not necessarily 100% flat, but we're 100% open.
Mm. And it's funny, this is becoming a more popular way of working, isn't it? I noticed that Buffer take that kind of approach as well, that they're really open about it, to the point that they publish everybody's salaries online and all that kind of stuff. It's interesting. It's an interesting way of working.
Mm. Yeah, and there was a few weeks ago on Twitter, there was kind of this meme, I guess, or this movement for everyone to share their salary numbers so other people could compare it. And we've always kind of taken that tact that more information is better, and it allows you to make better decisions. And if we can share our kind of what we've learned financially or code-wise or design with the world at large, then someone can learn from that. And if everyone does that, and then I think we can get better data, and with better data, you can make, you know, better decisions.
Because I remember at Future Web Design that you shared your salary there on stage, mm-hmm. and then you
my current salary is $75,000 Canadian plus benefits on top of that. There you go, folks.
There you go. So that means nothing to me.
Yeah, exactly. That could have been £1 million.
Yeah, you might be the richest person I've ever met, or you could be a pauper.
I can guarantee that I am not the richest person you've ever met.
So, but then you challenged other people to do the other speakers to do the same, and I was on directly after you. So thanks a lot for that.
Oh, you're welcome.
So I did, but I was the only one that did, wasn't I? Which was fascinating. I can't even answer that question anymore. I have no idea how much I earn anymore. My life is just so confusing.
Weird when you're comparing like salaried amounts to owners who take dividends and kind of the tax consequences of all of that. But, you know, some numbers are better than no numbers, I guess. Yeah, so yeah. I'm not going to make you say it out loud right here.
I will tell you. I'm happy to tell you. I take £4,500 out per month at the moment.
Now I have no idea if you're the richest person I've ever met, or yeah.
So we're absolutely wasted exercise. But no, I've always found that really interesting. I love the way that you share openly and you engage with the community. So you seem like the perfect person. Now, don't take this the wrong way, but you seem like the perfect person to get on this week's show, because we're talking about failure. Now, I'm not saying you fail a lot or any more than anybody else. But I just thought you're very honest and you're very open. So what a great person to have on the show. You're not the kind of person that strikes me that, you know, you talk about your failure and then somehow you make it sound so wonderful that actually it turned out to be a success because you learned some amazing lesson from it.
Yeah, that's just what people tell themselves to make themselves feel better.
Yeah. And that gets up my nose.
But I was, I mean, we tried to connect on another topic earlier, and then we kind of failed. And then you're like, well, you'd be great at failure. So I really wasn't sure what to take from that. But
Well, whoever I invited on this week's show was going to be deeply offended. There was no way around it, was there?
So I enjoyed looking back and kind of analyzing the failures that I have had. the few that I've written down, at least.
Well, yeah, we've got one or two, Marcus, haven't we, that we can share?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Most of last year.
Oh, one or two a month, I'm talking about.
One of the things that I just wanted to mention is, because obviously that the kind of openness about how Silver Orange is run and all those kind of things. Well, one of the things that you talked about when we interviewed you, this is probably 10 years ago now, isn't it? I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, long time ago. The other thing that was that really interested me and Paul, probably to a certain extent, was the way that you worked with some of your clients, which is basically this kind of, we'll do a load of work for you in exchange for basically a cut of what you sell.
So we call that working on commission.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as do we, but that kind of setup wasn't very kind of agency, you know, the where we'll go after a piece of work that has a set budget and we'll win that piece of work and then we might carry on doing more work for that particular client.
The model itself came out of absolute failure, in that it was kind of born out of necessity, where we were going after work like you described, where, you know, you'd put in a fixed price and mm-hmm. and hope to win the bid, and we kept losing bids over and over and over again. It turns out we were really expensive. Actually, we weren't really expensive. Everyone else was just stupid cheap.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the early days, as I'm sure you remember, where everyone and their dog was a web designer or developer.
Yeah.
And it was just driving prices through the floor. So we basically said, well, we have to win some business. So what if we just offer to do it for free in exchange for a percentage of whatever they sell online? Because there really was no one knew how big this whole internet thing was going to become. So we really were able to make some great bets early on and capitalize on those for a long, long time. And we ran commission agreements, and I still have some running. For 10 years, a decade with some clients.
Wow.
That's fantastic.
Do you still do that anymore, or have you kind of moved on?
I have two. That gets into kind of more of a nuanced question about what Silver Orange is up to these days. But we do still have two contracts that have a commission component in them.
Oh, I like the sound of that. So what are you up to these days? You've now piqued my interest. Are you now kind of running brothels or?
Oh, that's the other thing. You used to do building work as well. I forgot that.
We do building work. I actually had to ask some gentlemen to stop doing building work while I recorded this. So there's painting happening like 6 feet away from my desk right now. But no, we own a few. We own four buildings in Charlottetown, and we've been restoring them. They're old buildings, old for Canadian standards. They're 120 years old, and we've been restoring them back to their former beauty. That is financially, it's a very long play. It might be longer than our generation, it's very rewarding work. But for Silver Orange, other than restoring Victorian homes, we really, in the last, I would say, 5 years, and this is probably since the last time I had a really good chat with you guys, decided that having a whole bunch of clients was a big waste of time. Mm-hmm. And we decided to focus in on a few core clients and deepen our relationship with them. So anyone who worked in an agency knows that you're really just scrambling from one project to the next, and it's hard to get your mind deep into the project and provide meaningful work to the client. You're kind of just skimming the surface across the top, moving projects through. At least we were. And we decided that wasn't great value for us or for our client, and the administrative and cognitive overhead of doing that was just not worth it. So we fired a lot of our clients or asked them to go away. And focused in on three or four core clients and asked if we could do more work and more, you know, get deeper involved in the organization. And that's gone really well, to the point where now we're down to three and a half clients, really, and have significant contracts and work with them. And that might even shave down to one or two in the next year or two.
Now, I suspect Marcus is having the same skittish reaction I am. Every time I talk to you, Dan, you always scare me.
What if those clients go away?
There you go. I mean, if you lose one of those clients, that is a huge blow to your business.
It is, but we're so here's the other side of that. That's obviously, you know, having a few eggs in one basket is always nerve-wracking. But we're so deep into our clients' businesses now that there's no surprises. So, you know, we don't get a phone call that says it's over. We see that coming. We're in their, you know, we're part of their planning team. We're part of their core team.
Right.
There's no real uncertain future, or at least, you know, having done this for the last few years, we're much more stable and know the future much better than we ever have in the last 16 years of doing business.
Yeah, I mean, that is true, because you do have this kind of constant turnover of clients otherwise, don't you, mm-hmm. where you're going from client to client to client. It just, yeah, I need to process that. I always feel like this. Whenever I have a conversation with you, it's like, no, I need to go away and think about that. I don't know what I feel.
Yeah, the surprisingly, and these, you know, we thought this might become an issue, but as you start to limit the amount of clients you work with, and let's say you start to pick one horse and really, really, you know, deepen your relationship with them, your biggest issues aren't financial. They become cultural, and like, how does that business operate on a daily basis versus how your business operates on a daily basis? Mm. Surprise, surprise, you know, most of the clients we work with don't operate like we do. So we're starting to sort out kind of that relationship stuff at a deeper level than we ever have had to with clients.
Yeah. But I mean, the flip side of this, of course, is that you get really embedded into the company, and you get, you know, you become essentially their digital department, their digital team within the company, which I must imagine is incredibly satisfying.
It is. And we're able to influence things across the board in the company. I mean, everything from marketing to finances to business development to, you know, the core stuff that we do, which would be development and design. So it is really rewarding, and you're able to affect change in a much more meaningful way than coming in as a contractor for an eight week project.
So how do you have you done anything to mitigate the risk there of somebody disappearing, or are you just kind of, you know, hoping it doesn't fail?
Well, I mean, obviously we're hoping it doesn't fail. I mean, we're getting into the core content here of the show, but. The mitigation was in which clients we go after in the first place. So
yes.
You know, we sat down and analyzed who we work with and say, okay, who's going to be here for a long time? Who do we really like working with? Life's too short to work with jerks. So we kind of did like an analysis of all clients and all characteristics of our clients or potential clients, like imaginary clients. Who do we want to work with at this level? And then whittle down the list from there. And so that's kind of how we mitigated our risk. And then every year we review things and see how we like it and, you know, figure out, okay, is it time to move on? Should we figure something else out? And so far it's going well.
How do you kind of broach that conversation? Dear Mr. Client, we like you. Give us more money. We want to work with you a lot more.
Well, you've probably had a few clients too that they just seem to have an endless appetite for what you do.
Yeah,
and we found that you can nurture that and supply that. And instead of saying, oh, we can't get to that right away, you say, yes, we can get to that right away. So there is an awkward period. There was a very awkward period of having a lot, you know, a dozen or two dozen clients and going down to two and having to promise them more work while you're still jettisoning the legacy stuff you've been doing. So we've finally gotten over that hump and are able to actually kind of get involved. And it's a lot like an employee. Like, the best employees are the ones who come to you and say, like, is there anything else I can help you with? And we discovered that if you just start doing that with your clients, you can drum up quite a bit more work.
Yeah, that is so true. It's like, you know, one of the things that I do as part of this mentorship that I've started offering is I try and arrange kind of weekly calls with people just to kind of keep pushing them forward. And it's amazing what comes out of that, not just for me, but for Headscape and for other people as well. Of, you know, if you can kind of help the client get momentum going in their digital work, then additional work starts appearing. It's just a matter of being proactive and pushing them.
Yeah, yeah. And we operate under the kind of the philosophy that nothing happens unless it intentionally happens. Hmm. So we're very organized for a group of guys who just like, we basically just say, this is what we would like to have happen. How do we get there? And we kind of lay out those steps and measure them and try things and see what works and then adjust the course as we go on.
See, we need you on next week's show when we talk about sales. You know, we're basically... We can just get rid of all those other guests. Just get you on the whole time.
But I've been making a lot of sales calls lately on behalf of our client. I'm doing some biz dev work for them, business development work.
For the client? That's
for the client, yeah. Just because, well, my job traditionally has been business development, but yeah. when you take go from having 2 dozen clients to having 3, my time gets freed up quite a bit.
This sounds
that's
like
what
excellent.
All of this has been about, isn't it, basically?
Absolutely. It's, yeah. So I can lie on a hammock and drink sangria.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, before we get too deeply into I can feel
I just want to ask one more question.
Oh, go on then.
Can you give me an indication of what sort of clients these are? You don't have to say exactly who they are or anything like that, but you know, what were you selling, for example?
What am I personally? Or what am I selling on behalf of
on the behalf of that client? Yeah, I'm just kind of. Are they big, huge companies? Are they middle?
No, second? They're not huge. The company I'm currently doing some business development for is a company called Hippo Education, and they are one of our biggest clients. And they are a medical education client.
Okay.
And I was doing some. They have some new products, and I was just kind of doing some preliminary market. Work to see what kind of pickup it would have, and I've discovered very quickly that. Calling people to do sales calls, cold calls especially, you talk to a lot of voicemails. That's pretty much, you have to be like a master message leaver to be a successful salesperson.
I can't stand cold calling.
Me neither. Oh, hate it.
Yeah. Anyway, that's next week.
That's next week.
Next week. Let's quickly mention our sponsor before we get into the main topic, which is, as you have gathered, talking about failure. Our sponsor this week, as every week on this season of the podcast, is Template Monster, that have been incredibly supportive of BOAG World generally, not just the podcast, but they've been doing some stuff on the blog, and I'm doing some video content for them. So they are my favourite client at the moment. And they pay for the transcriptions for this show and for my sangria and hammocks, which is very important. So please make sure you check out their website. Otherwise, I might run out of sangria and hammocks. They've got an amazing collection of templates on their website. Something like 46,000 templates with some really funky stuff, including parallax, lazy loading, gorgeous animation stuff. You know, if you are not in a position where every website you can build is bespoke, if you are looking for a website for your own organization and you can't go afford to hire the likes of Headscape or Silver Orange, then definitely check them out. They're a wonderful option. And as well, you know, when you're faced with 46,000 templates, that can be a little overwhelming, but they are organized into lots of categories, so you can find categories that relate to your business. But they also have a service that will help you find the template that best fits you, and they even have a customization service if you're not a coder and you want someone to set all of this stuff up for you. So check them out at boagworld.com/templatemonster. I really do appreciate their involvement in the show. And they're very prompt payers as well, in case you want to know. That's another good thing. In fact, I chased them today for a payment that was overdue, and they paid me ages ago, and I just hadn't noticed. Now, that is an embarrassing conversation to have.
Yet another failure, Paul.
Another failure, which brings us on beautifully to our topic for today. I seem to be somewhat of an expert in this area.
Mm.
Did we talk on the podcast, Marcus, about what Rob said at the project management conference he was at recently?
We did, but we didn't go into any detail. We were going to save it for this week.
Were we?
Yeah, and interesting, you spoke to me earlier about the CASE conference. I think it was the CASE conference where...
Oh, no, yes.
Where you had been booked in to give a talk, and you thought it was on, let's say, the Thursday, and you were preparing yourself early in the week to get up there on the Thursday, and you got up on the Wednesday morning, and you got a phone call saying, "Where are you, Paul? You're on stage in half an hour."
No, it was worse than that. Well, you've told the story completely wrong. But
this is 500 miles from home.
Yeah, it was. So I was in Dorset. This was in Liverpool, which is a long way. And I was sitting there at my desk, happily getting on my work. Little pop-up notification from Twitter, looking forward to introducing Paul in half an hour. They hadn't even noticed I wasn't there. So that was massively embarrassing, yes. Just one of my many failures. And our first question is, I would love to hear some examples of your failures and what you learned from them. I think I learned that I'm an idiot, basically. I think that was about as much as I learned from that one.
You probably learned the value of brown pants as well.
Yeah, quite possibly. So, go on then, Dan. It sounds like you've got some failures that you'd made a note of. Would you like to share any of them?
Oh, boy, would I ever. There's nothing better than... I have, like, three categories of failures as I started to analyze them. There's relationships, straight up, normal, everyday relationship
failures. Are we talking about business here, or are we talking about
personal relationships? Well, that's my next category here. I'm talking, romantic relationship failures.
Because I want to make it clear, this is not a therapy session.
Crap, all my notes are just useless now. And then I kind of have like business failures and personal failures. So personal failures would be like failures about myself that don't affect necessarily other people directly.
Yeah, okay.
So we're going to skip over the relationship ones because that's not
good.
This topic. Yeah. But business failures, two really jump to mind. And these would be like, these are, in the bankrupt kind of failure category. So when I was in college, university, my roommate and I at the time, we shared an apartment, decided that this was 1999. We decided that this internet thing was going well. We had Silver Orange hadn't quite started yet. But I did have another little web design company with a friend of mine, and this was a different friend. So we've got two guys that I have two separate companies with. And we decided to start a travel website for Prince Edward Island, which is the province of Canada that I live in, which is a very prominent tourism destination. Mm-hmm. So we thought, wouldn't it be amazing? And this sounds so funny, 16 years later. Wouldn't it be amazing if you could go on the internet and book a hotel room and a golf tee off time at the same time? We're a big golf destination.
Right.
So we were 19 years old at the time, and this is 1999. So like the bubble's just booming, it just hasn't quite popped yet. And we came up with this idea. We were going to go and secure inventory in golf courses and hotels and then sell that inventory online, to all of the millions of people who were on the internet at that point. So, not only but the problem was both of us, I was a designer to start. I could write HTML, in the Blink tag era. He was a business student at the time, so we had to hire some people to actually build it, and to hire people costs money. So we used our boyish good looks and charm to go raise $250,000 Canadian from friends, family, investors, and there was some local entrepreneurship programs that pitched in as well. And then hired a team of people to build this website. And we went and we secured at the time. It was, I can't even believe they gave it to us, being 19-year-old guys full of piss and vinegar. They gave us inventory at all the golf courses, all the top golf courses in our province, which are some of the top ones in Canada. And most of the hotels, some of the biggest hotel chains in our area, gave us almost full access to their inventory to sell online.
Wow.
And so we built this site. We spent $250,000. We bought a full page ad in Golf Magazine, I think it was, or Golf Digest or something, like a big golf thing, and got this website up and running. And we sold in the first 6 months a single package. And here's the best part. The person who bought it didn't feel comfortable using their credit card on the internet, so they had to call us to make the reservation.
You're just ahead of your time, that's all.
And that's my note on that, is that like we executed very well. Like our time to market was very fast. We developed pretty well. The product was actually very good, but we failed. Here's the word. We failed to time it properly in the market. We were just ahead of ourselves in that thing. The silver lining of all of that story is that the team that was brought together to build that project for that company is the team that became Silver Orange.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, so then that turned into something good.
It did turn into something good, but it was, $250,000 for two 19-year-olds. It took a while to dig out from underneath that giant financial wet blanket.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. I mean, to be quite honest, I'm impressed you managed to do all of that as 19-year-old. So I think back to when I was 19, and that wouldn't have happened with me.
The impressive part was that we were able to do all that, and yet still I played video games for at least 6 hours every day.
it's not a million miles from our story, Paul.
Although, which one are you talking about?
The our previous existence, which wasn't really our failure.
No.
So I guess I'll very briefly mention that we used to work for a company called Town Pages, which was a dot-com that was going to make millions from kiosks in venues around the country. And that didn't work out, which wasn't really our fault, so it wasn't really our failure, as I mentioned. But the team that built it went on to become largely Headscape. So there is a similarity there.
The difference, I think, between Town Pages... So Town Pages was basically to provide local information via the internet and touchscreen kiosks. So it was kind of a... It was a bit like something like Foursquare or Yelp or that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But they recognised that not everybody had internet at home, so they decided they were going to do these touchscreen kiosks. But... All of these touchscreen kiosks they put all over the place. So they did deals with, you know, kind of local governments and that kind of stuff to put these kiosks in. They all had to be connected via what was it?
ISDN.
ISDN lines.
Oh my
yes.
goodness!
Yeah. So which cost a fortune. And then, of course, all of the they had to be repaired because they got vandalised and they had to be cleaned. All the rest of it. Just a huge amount of debt. But the funny thing was. Is all of this was they were going to get their revenue back through advertising. That was the logic, and selling advertising. But I once sat down and worked out how long it took us to put each advert online onto the website, and the cost that they sold the advert for. And that alone didn't add up. So it cost more money to create the ads than it did we earned from them, without taking into account the touchscreen kiosk or the 100 people that worked there at one point.
It was
just fantasy. Yeah. But at that time, you know, people gave you money at a drop of a hat, didn't they? I mean, you managed to raise, you know, a quarter of a million, you know, and that was a couple of 19-year-olds. That's what it was like. It was
a
just
couple
crazy.
Of 19-year-olds in very poor fitting suits in the basement of a very cheap hotel doing a sale, like a presentation. So,
yes. Do you have any other failures that you wish to get off of your chest, Dan? Because we've got one more if you don't.
Do I ever? So, about 5 or 6 years ago, something weird, like it must have been coincidence or it was just kind of timing on the internet. A bunch of us in the office here, so at that time we'd have about 10 or 12 people working, and we all had these photo galleries up, and there was just a little a piece of software we wrote as Silver Orange to host photos and share them with our friends and families. This is kind of Flickr had already started, and it was really popular, but we had built this before that, so we were kind of using it. But a bunch of us sold photos. So we had taken photos of, you know, everything from a condor in Peru to a messy desk, believe it or not. And in the span of a few months, we had sold 5 or 6 photos as individuals. And we thought, holy cow, it kind of opened our eyes to the photo buying and selling marketplace. And we decided to wade into that marketplace because, as we all know, there's stock photo sites that are, you know, they charge $1 or $10 or 5 credits or whatever it is for use. And we kind of realized that photos were going to become this endless commodity, that there's just going to be so many of them that you could monetize them at a cheaper price point and allow people to sell them directly from one person to the other and set their own licensing and all that kind of stuff. So we started a site called ClusterShot, and we poured our own like kind of evenings and weekends into it for months, and we launched it, and we had people using it, which, you know, a lot of failures in this space are like they launched a product and no one ever used it. So we had thousands of users. And then on top of that, we had a pro subscription that you could pay. I think it was $50 a year for extra features that pro photographers could use. And we managed to secure an API key with Flickr. So you could just like type in your Flickr username and password, and it would automatically ingest all your photos, and you could set pricing based on that. And it was a really, it was a great service, and a lot of people liked it. But it just wasn't great enough. And, you know, after about 2 years of giving it a go, and it was only generating thousands of dollars in revenue, we decided to pull the plug on it, and we actually just sold it auction style there was a group of, I think, 10 companies that were bidding on it. And, I mean, we sold it for like $17,000 or something, you know, a pittance like that. We didn't even cover our cost of hosting probably at the time. But, you know, we had poured a lot of energy into that thing and came away with virtually nothing.
Yeah, that's an amateur failure. We can do better than that. Marcus, do you want to tell him about Get Sign Off?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I remember this product.
Yeah. I mean, it, just to kind of, as a bit of preamble towards that, I think, and this goes back to when we first, what I was saying earlier about when we first met you, Dan, and all these ideas came out, and we're like, we could try that, and we could try that. And I'd say my biggest business failure has not been able to make these new ideas happen. Like you're saying that, you know, you decided, whenever it was a few years ago, that you were going to reduce your clients to two or three. You know, that I know for a fact that if we decided to go down a similar route, we'd fail at it because we just carry on doing the same thing over and over. It continues to work, so it's not a dreadful failure. But we have never really managed to kind of break out of what we have been for the last 13 years we've been in business. But this story, though, is a very good example of that. We've listened to many people saying that what you need to be doing is, you know, to get away from that kind of endless cliff of what's the next project going to be, you know, what are we going to be doing in 6 months' time? You need to basically create some kind of product, something that will give you a consistent revenue. And at the time, we thought, well, what could that be? And we sat around, I think it was at South by Southwest. You and I and Chris sat around having a beer, going over ideas, and we came up with the idea of Get Sign Off, which was basically a facility for designers to basically help sell their design work to their clients and give clients the ability to comment on them and all that kind of thing. So pretty good idea. And similarly to you, Dan, we did manage to get people to sign up for it, but it just took too long. That was the problem. We took long to get to market.
Yeah, it was almost the opposite of the problem you had, Dan, with your first idea, mm-hmm. that by the time we'd executed the idea, the industry had moved on, or at least our own thinking had moved on, and we weren't tending to deliver static comps anymore. We were, you know, designing in the browser, and we were, you know, prototyping and these kinds of things. And so it just, we missed the window. Mm. Add to that, I think we were rubbish at marketing it.
Well, yeah, we spent a lot of money.
I tend to agree that most of new business challenges is a marketing issue, not a technology issue or a product issue. Mm.
Yeah, but it's funny because in other ways, I'm actually quite good at marketing, you know, through reputation building and all of those kinds of things. But I couldn't make the mental switch for some reason to go to, you know, promoting a product. It was a really weird one. And I think by the time we'd managed to execute it, I'd lost interest, which probably didn't help.
Yeah. So I mean, back to kind of the core of both of those stories of our photo selling one and Get Sign Off is there's an enormous pressure on agencies to become a product company. And I think if I was to put my finger on it, it goes back to 37 Signals, who started as an agency at almost the exact same time we did. I mean, we knew Jason, you know, we hung out a few times, we got to know him, and they made this miraculous switch from being an agency to being a very successful product company with Basecamp. And we had a similar product to Basecamp at the time we were using internally. So we always, for years, probably 7 or 8 years, we always had that kind of that philosophy that we're going to be failures at the service industry, so we have to make a product, or there's only there's a cap on how much money you can make as a service company, either work more hours or, you know, charge more per hour. And eventually, after ClusterShot failed, we had a very honest conversation that says the DNA of our company is a service company. We need a client. That is how we operate. Let's stop trying to be something that we're not. And ever since we made that decision, things have gone much better.
We did exactly the same thing, didn't
we? Absolutely. And I think, I often think with 37 Signals, is where would they be now if they hadn't come up with Basecamp? Would they be having the same conversation that we're having now?
It's just they would probably be talking to you today instead of me.
Could well be, yeah.
But, you know, if you have a massive hit, then that guides, I mean, to the point of they dropped all their other products a couple of years ago. They realized that that's what they were all about. So I think without that massive hit, then they'd probably end up being an agency a bit like us, maybe more product focused, but still working for clients.
But yeah. There's kind of both what they've done recently in dropping a load of products and what we've just said about we realized we were a service business, because that was another big part of it, that we didn't have the mentality for a product. Mm-hmm. You know, we are a service-based business. But it brings us quite nicely onto the, I would say, second question, but it's not really a question so much as a comment, which is there's a lot of talk about failure being a good thing. That seems ridiculous to me. Why would you want to fail? And I don't think it's necessarily that you want to fail, but by pushing into other areas, by pushing outside of your comfort zones, whether that be, you know, creating your photo sharing app or our design sign off app, or even in 37 Signals case, to branch out from their core product and look at other things, it kind of, you get to know what you're good at. You know, you get to learn more about yourself through your failures. So I think that's a big part of why failure is not necessarily a good thing. It's not, you shouldn't set out, I'm going to fail today. I want to fail. But when you are, I think there's a lot to be learned from it.
There definitely is. But the, you know, everyone talks about, you know, failure is a good thing. But I think it's clear to say those people talking about it are people who have then gone on to success.
Yeah, exactly.
There have been a lot of people who have failed and now they're working, you know, to support their families in jobs that they hate. And, you know, they haven't been able to get over the repeated failures or the massive failure that they had. And they're just not part of the conversation.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
There's also the old adage, and I think this is what what's being referenced here, is the adage that, I don't know, related to say something like skiing or something, if you don't fall over, then you're not trying hard enough. So I think relating that to business is that if you don't take any risks or you don't try anything new, then chances are you're going to stagnate and fail. So you need to try risky stuff, which might involve failing to get to the better place at the end.
And I think there is a degree of how much you risk as well. Because, you know, with Get Sign Off, we didn't bet the business on it.
No.
Mm.
You know, with your photo sharing app, or even better, probably, example is the very first, you know, adventure that you undertook. You know, you were young. You could afford to take those risks. And the consequences weren't as enormous.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, as a 19-year-old, you know, the financial consequences seemed enormous at the time, but life was this long journey ahead of us that we could make up any mistake we made. It's much different now, being 36 years old and having a child, and, you know, most of the people in our office are in that situation. They've got families, and it's different than being a bunch of young guys.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
You
it
are still young things. Guys. I need to make that point now. You are young guys.
You make a good point as well when you talked about how some people have failed and never managed to get over it. And so we're not hearing from them. One of the questions that somebody asked is, you know, mentally failing can be really quite tough. How do you stop yourself getting demoralized after repeat failures? So, I mean, a great example of that on a micro level is what you've just been doing, which is a load of cold calling. You know, and cold calling is failure after failure after failure. It's one rejection after another after another. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Poorly.
Oh, right.
So, I actually find, in that specific case, I find just not caring is the best way to do it. Because, you know, in cold calling, it's not that, you know, you've failed. It's just that you're not making the connection that you need to make. And so you're hunting for that needle in a haystack.
Yeah.
So it's not technically failing, as far as I look at. That's what I tell myself so I can sleep at night, at least.
Fair enough.
Yeah, yeah.
So what about your, you know, when you did the photo site that didn't come off, did you find it hard to rebound from that and find your direction again?
A little bit, but like I said, this was a side project of Silverhorn. So a lot like you folks, we didn't have the mourning period after it, because we had work to do in our core business. So we didn't really have, there was definitely a like, frig, we should have tried this, we should have tried that. And we had a pretty extensive post-mortem that led to some healthy things for the company. But I didn't really have a lot of sense of, I wasn't demoralized, I guess. And the I think the other important thing is that not everyone is suited for trying things that can fail at that kind of level. Some people just don't want to try that or don't get anything out of that. So, you know, this isn't for everyone. Being an entrepreneur is not for everyone. And I think you guys would know that just as well as I would.
That brings us on to another kind of slightly different scenario. And I'm not, it's quite an interesting question somebody asked, and I don't know whether I've really got the answer to it. This person says, I work for a big company which seems to have a culture of fear. How do I, as a manager, make failure acceptable within my team? Because the truth is that when you're working on any digital project, right, let's say you're working on a website. If you want to improve that website, the only way you can improve it is you can come up with a hypothesis, you put that online, you test it, you see whether it flies or not when real users use it. That's the kind of basis of good web design. Mm-hmm. But that means a big chunk of those ideas are not going to work. And if you work in an organization where that kind of failure, inverted commas, is unacceptable because you've wasted effort in something that hasn't flown, that's a really difficult environment for digital to flourish in. And it's kind of quite difficult to know how to deal with that.
My notes on that, I'm just looking at what I wrote down, is that you have to trick your company into letting you do that kind of stuff. And I think it's all a semantic issue. That if you can start to use terms, instead of saying, like, we're going to try a new project, you can use, like, a pilot project. And, you know, try and avoid using words that indicate, like, long-term commitment. So if you're going to do something, say, like, we're just going to try it for a few weeks and see what happens. And try and minimize the effect of that. And if you're in a big company, it's very unlikely that you're in a position to sink the whole company with your digital experiment. I mean, if you are in that position, then you should definitely ask for more compensation. But I think you just have to kind of use soft terms, use words and terminology that can excite wonder and exploration in people, because people tend to want to discover things. So if you can use language and tact that leans that way, you'd probably have a little bit more success. And then also, I don't work in big companies, and I never have, but I have worked for big companies as an agency. I think you do have a little bit of an onus to demonstrate, you know, kind of the constraints of the test that you're going to run, and say, like, this is why we're doing this. This is what we hope to gain from it. And this is going to be, you know, the cost of doing so. And I think this goes back. I don't know if we skipped over it or not.
We've skipped all over the place. Randomly let the conversation go.
I think, like, you have to define what failure is and what success is. And then you have to aggressively monitor it. And then at Silver Orange, we do pre-mortems and we do post-mortems on projects. And we talk about how things could go wrong before we even do the project, to make sure that we kind of imagine our way around some obstacles. And then after our project's done, we do a post-mortem. And it's like, some of our project post-mortems are entire days or 2 days of most of the team sitting down and talking through. And we try and boil off kind of the water to get down to the substance, to see if there's any lessons we can learn for the future. And I think if you can document that and show that to kind of your boss or the organization, and say, like, we're hoping to learn some really key things to our business to make ourselves more profitable in the future, or to learn these key things that'll avoid these pitfalls, it'll be a more sellable idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know, we haven't touched on half of the questions that we've got on this issue. It's just, I think people have this real, they kind of know that experimentation is a key part of web design, and that there is associated risk with failing in doing that. But they're quite unsure about how to encourage that in people. One of the things I like about this question is it says, how do I, as a manager, make failure acceptable within my team? And that makes me think about some of the things that we've done in Headscape over the years. Things like we have a Muppet Award, right?
Yes,
which is a stupid thing that I don't know even how it started. I think it was Rob, wasn't it, started it?
I can't remember.
Anyway, whoever started it. So we have this, a Muppet from the Muppets. And every time you messed up, you got the Muppet. The Muppet would sit on your desk. And it was kind of, it became our way of giving permission to people to mess up. You know, having the Muppet wasn't a thing of shame. It wasn't like going to the corner and wearing a dunce's cap. It was, you know, it was almost a kind of lightning.
It was, Paul. It's just you won it so much. That's what you're saying to yourself.
Is that it? So I'm going to end on that note.
I just thought of another answer for your listener's question, is that I think what I would do then is try and create the incentives in my organization to be more process-oriented. So instead of, you know, focusing on the end result, focus on the process. Did you go through a proper process when testing this new idea? And if so, let's reward that and encourage that. And then the outcome becomes kind of the thing that it doesn't not matter, but it becomes secondary to doing a good process. And if you do a process that's kind of ideal and gets fine-tuned over time, you're going to have those successes eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I spend a lot of time with my clients helping them establish, you know, kind of a framework within which to do digital. But because having those kinds of processes and those frameworks in place, it provides a place of safety, you know, and it provides a set of criteria to work within. Anyway, we must move on. For a start, I want to mention our final sponsor of the day before we get on to the most important part of the show. Dan, I don't know whether you're aware of this, but we do end with Marcus telling a joke.
Wow.
And it is a special moment. And, you know, just prepare yourself for painful
laughter. For the disappointment.
Laughter.
Yeah, I only have one joke, and it's about a proctologist, so I'll leave it to Marcus.
You've got a young daughter. Surely you've got jokes that you tell with her.
They're horrible. She's only 18 months, so she doesn't
still
quite have language yet.
No. Anyway, right. So our second sponsor on this show is Lynda.com. Also have, you know, a wonderful sponsor that's supporting the whole season. They've got over 3,000 on-demand video courses on business, creativity, technical skills, stuff like that. I think they've been around almost as long as Silver Orange have. They're a great place to learn new skills, design websites, coding applications, running businesses, whatever. In fact, I went along and I had a look today at what they've got on failure. I thought they're not going to have anything on failure. They've actually got loads. Here's some of the videos they've got on failure. Design for failure, planning for failure, moving past business failure, putting failure in its place, celebrating success and accepting failure, the importance of failure, learning from failure, embracing failure. So if you want to know more about failure, then go along to Lynda.com. They've got thousands of courses that you can stream on demand and learn at your own schedule. The courses are broken down into bite-sized chunks, so you can do as much or as little at one time as you want to. You get access to all of that failure for one flat fee. 10 days free trial. You can find out more about them at Lynda.com/BoagWorld.
It sounds like you should listen to all of those things or watch those videos before you listen to us rant about it.
Yeah, really. I think you'll get a much more kind of cohesive discussion of the issue than us rambling about it. But no, it's been really interesting. Failure is a really difficult one because, you know, on one hand, you want to create an environment where failure is okay. But on the other hand, it's not desirable. You know, you don't go out of your way to fail. So there's a balance there somewhere. Marcus, talking of failure, do you want to give us a joke that won't make us laugh?
I'll do my best. This one kind of carries on from the joke from a couple of weeks ago, which we felt wasn't really that appropriate.
So you felt the need to carry on anyway?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it was to do with the guy getting rid of the son, that joke. In place of the dog. Anyway, that's not this week's joke.
Anyway, I don't remember our previous jokes that you've told.
This is
from Darryl
again. I blank
them from my mind.
Here we go. I was digging a hole in the back garden today when I found a pile of buried treasure. I was so excited I ran inside to tell my wife, but then I remembered why I was digging the hole in the first place.
That's terrible.
See?
That's like right out there with kind of 1970s, you know. Take my wife.
Laughing,
no, really, take her.
Anyway. Can I tell my proctologist joke?
Do
I don't get many opportunities to do
go
it.
Go on then.
So everyone knows what a proctologist is, I imagine. If you don't, you can take this 4 seconds to Google it. So a proctologist walks into an examination room and, you know, looks at his patient and reaches up into his pocket, pulls out his thermometer, and he looks at it and says, "Oh no, some bum's got my pen."
Oh no. That's as bad.
Yes. Excellent. That's the proper level of joke we like on this show.
Yeah.
That's disgraceful.
Sorry about that.
So that's it for this week. Dan, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really
fun. My pleasure, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant.
Great to talk to you, Dan.
Next week, we are following up on the subject we talked about earlier. We're going to be talking about sales leads and winning that work and closing those deals and all those other kinds of things. How to go about that. How to make it not too painful a process. I have no idea who's going to be joining us next week on the show, so it might just be me and Marcus if we can't find anyone to discuss sales, or we get Dan back on. Yeah, that solves the problem.
A regular columnist now.
Yeah, exactly. All right, thank you guys for joining us today. Have a really great week, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Bye.